created live on Fireside.
Scott, how are you? Great to have you here.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me here tonight.
Very, very excited. You have such an incredible background. I mean, so many different things you've done, much more than many, for sure. And I'll start with a brief background on your career, and then maybe you can expand upon that as you see fit. How does that sound?
That sounds great. I'll follow your lead.
Love it. So Scott is a corporate therapist, a strategic thinker, and a trusted advisor. He's over 2 decades of experience in marketing, communications, influencer management, digital and social media, and audience development. He's served as a trusted advisor to executives in a variety of companies and industries, including Walmart, IBM, Google, Ford Motor Company, which we will of course come back to, Coca-Cola, and others. I mean, very impressive. Currently a communication executive at Chameleon Collective, podcast host at Timeless Leadership, of course, his incredible show Via Fireside, and founder of Scott Monte Strategies. And that's just what he's doing right now. We haven't even covered some of the amazing things that you've done in your past. But so Scott, so great to have you. Is there anything else you'd like to say regarding introducing yourself?
Oh my gosh, I could go in probably 58 different directions, but let's just dive right into the conversation.
I think one of the things that jumped out right at the beginning to me when doing some due diligence on you was your incredibly interesting college experience. So you got 3 separate degrees at Boston University, incredible school in Boston. And so first I'll say what they were. So you got your bachelor's in classic civilization, and then you got this very unique dual degree that I have simply never heard of, master's in medical science with the dual degree with an MBA in healthcare management. Please tell me how you decided to go down this incredibly diverse path for your education.
Well, when I got to Boston University, I had intended to go to medical school. I was on the pre-med track of education. And with pre-med, pre-med isn't a major. It's a track of study. So you have to declare a major. And my uninformed and very milquetoast college advisor said, well, you should be a biology major because that's what most pre-med people are. So I said, all right, I'll declare a biology major. Well, early on, I found that, you know, I wanted to branch out. I wanted to do more than just science because I figured if I'm at a liberal arts school, I should take in as much as I can before I am given a lifetime sentence to sciencing. And I took a classics course, Classics 101, Greek Civilization, and had a professor that simply made the past come alive for me. He was a remarkable storyteller. He was emotional. He was engaged. He was everything you would want a college professor to be. And it really turned me on to wanting to learn more about ancient civilization. And in doing so, I realized, well, I can study history. I can study architecture, art, drama, politics, even sports. You know, took a full range of classes within classics and then still pursued where I was going with medicine. And at that point, you know, I was president of the pre-med society. I was on this path that I had promised myself, but I was starting to have doubts. And I thought, well, why don't I take the equivalent of the first year of medical school, which is the Master's of Medical Science that BU offered. And what you would do is if you've completed that year, which included a thesis on top of the first year of medical school, is you could go on to the second year of medical school in an MD track. But it was about halfway through that where I realized, you know what? I really don't care for science. I don't enjoy studying it. I don't get as much satisfaction out of it. And quite frankly, the portion of medicine that I was most interested in was, you know, relating to a patient, taking their history, getting to know them, asking questions and discovering things along that line. And there are fields of medicine where you can do that, obviously psychiatry, but you still have to have a really good grounding in science. So I thought, well, rather than give up on the master's degree, you know, there are some people that go on and obviously do medical school. There are others that do a PhD in bench research science, obviously not my cup of tea. But there was also a third line that I could go into, and that was to link it up with an MBA at BU's business school. So I'd be registered at the medical school and the business school and pursue an MBA with a concentration in healthcare management. Now, at the time, this was when Bill Clinton was president, and there was this healthcare reform possibility. And I thought, well, if the healthcare system gets reformed, they're going to need someone who knows a little bit about science, but also a little bit about business. So I would basically be a double threat. So when I came out of medical school, that's what I did. I went to work for a managed care company until I realized just how miserable managed care was, which led into consulting in the biotech and medical device and pharmaceutical space in the deal-making side of things there. And that eventually led to advertising and marketing, which led to social media. So it was kind of like one thing after another, where each linked to the next, but I had no idea what the long-term plan was at each step of the way.
That's really interesting, talking about no long-term plan. I'm sure you had some idea of where you wanted to go, but if you were playing your cards where it was like, okay, this is the next step, I'm doing this first, I'll do this next, what is your North Star at a younger age? What were you trying to work towards? Or was there something that at the very beginning of your career that you're like, okay, maybe if I approach this goal by starting in healthcare management, maybe I can get there. Was there any sort of sense?
Well, I think, you know, to me, the early goal was obviously medicine in some way. And it had initially been on the physician side and then decided to be on the business side. But the idea was to simply contribute to, you know, improving the experience for people. And when I realized that managed care was having more of an outsized impact on the medical field, I thought I might be able to do more on that side of medicine than I might on the physician side. And I should add that while I was going through this process of deciding which route to take in medical school and in business and whatnot, I had spoken to, gosh, maybe 47, 48 doctors, you know, as in my capacity in the pre-med society. And about half of the physicians I spoke with were completely dissatisfied with the profession. And I thought, if I have to spend that number of years and that kind of tuition to become an MD, and I walk away being dissatisfied with the job, that's a huge, huge mistake. And it's a huge investment to make, time and money, in your life. And that's why I started thinking, well, is there another way to go about this? Is there another way to remain involved and active and a contributor in the medical field without going that route? And that's why I thought, well, managed care seems to be the way. Well, for anyone who's dealt with an insurance company, as we all have, a healthcare company, it can be a little frustrating. Well, guess what? It's really frustrating on the inside too. And I felt like, you know, at least at the level I was at, I wasn't going to see any kind of, I don't want to say immediate result, because it's not that I'm looking for short-term results, but I just felt like I wasn't making a difference the way I thought I could. I felt like more of a cog in a machine. And when I left the managed care company and went to work for in biotech and pharmaceutical consulting, I was working for a family business, and their clients were early stage companies that had promising technology and had the scientific know-how but needed a boost, whether it was additional team members or additional investments to bring their promising drugs or devices to the market. And I thought, well, you know, you can see something go along a path from phase two to phase three to the marketplace in that. And you can see these small business people, you can see their lives being changed as a result of these kinds of licensing arrangements that we were responsible for. And certainly in the pharmaceutical, biotech, and medical device field, you can see people's lives impacted as patients. And to me, that was incredibly gratifying. And to me, that was part of the longer term plan, was to contribute to improving people's lives in some way.
Wow, that's really fascinating, Scott. 40 people. I mean, I don't know if, you know, personally, I don't know if I would have done that much homework on my own, but, you know, kudos to you. You've really done your homework and talked to, you know, individuals in the industry to make sure that's something you want to get into. Because I'm sure, Ben, you can relate to this too, and I'm sure our listeners as well, is sometimes we found ourselves working in industry that we're not really passionate, right? So come down to chase the money or to get a job after college. But it seems like you've been trying to, since the very early stage of your career, you've been trying to find your why. You've been trying to find your purpose in life. And you know, by talking to people and try different things and, you know, get into different industries, then you find now is to help people and make impact to the world. So that's really inspiring, Scott.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something, Jen. I still feel like I'm looking for it. You know, I don't feel like I've you know, found the golden thread, but that's, to me, that's part of life. That's part of what makes this interesting, is, you know, keeping your mind open, being prepared for what options come along. Because look, the world is constantly changing. And if you asked yourself, you know, would we be where we are today, you know, in this place and time with certain developments or whatever, a year or 2 years ago, you probably wouldn't have. So it's about remaining open to options and being constantly curious and pushing yourself, you know, and to me, the more people I meet, and the more people I talk to, and the more people I listen to, quite frankly, the more I feel that is open to me. And I may look at what I'm doing on any given day or year and think, is this the best I can be? Am I doing what I set out to do? You know, I've run into a lot of people since we started here on Fireside a few months ago, who are just blown away by my voice, you guys included. And suddenly I'm thinking, well, should I pursue something where I can do something with my voice? If I can contribute to something meaningful for people, something that helps them either improve themselves or improve the state of the world, and, oh, by the way, I happen to be using my voice, then so be it. I mean, that's one of the reasons I started my show here on Fireside.
It's so true. It's about understanding what your skills are in combination with what you want to achieve. And that's the action that you take going forward, whether it's talking about career, life, really anything. If we're talking about relationships with people, what are your skills compared to your partners, and why would you be good together? Or in the workplace, what can you leverage professionally to then not only help yourself climb the ladder or get to the next stage in your career, but also help a company, and a company is, of course, people. So helping other people around you. So it's really interesting that you talk about that. And it's probably great that you haven't exactly found that thing, because I feel like life, that's what kind of life is all about. You don't want to find the one thing that it's like, okay, well, this is my life's purpose. I found this right now. Here we go. That's it. So that chase is probably, I mean, that's probably driven you, no?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it comes down to something that Arthur Fiedler once said. Arthur Fiedler, of course, was the first conductor of the Boston Pops, led them for 50 years. And he, I think he conducted like up until a week or so before his death. And so he was really active. And he said, if you rest, you rot. And to me, that's exactly what we're talking about here. To me, it's always being curious. It's chasing things down. It's reading, it's interacting. And you're a different person today than you were the day before, than you were the year before.
Is the constant learning mindset. You know, if you stop learning, you're going to get old, right?
That's right. That's right.
And I kind of want to touch on that a little bit more. It's almost like the unfair advantage, you know, to your point. It's like, understand, like Ben said, your uniqueness and your strength, and really leverage that to your advantage, you know, and if you can help people with that, that'd be the perfect scenario.
You know, we all have different strengths, different talents, different things that we bring to the table. No two of us are exactly alike. And if we can recognize people for their strengths, you know, there's often been this debate is, you know, should I work on my weaknesses? Well, I'm of the camp that thinks you should focus on your strengths and continue to hone them, because that's what will make you stand out. If you simply take a weakness and bring it up to a mediocrity, that's really not that impressive. But if you can focus on your strength, if you can minimize your weakness, right, either move away from that stuff, delegate it to other people, or just move away from it and focus on what you do well, that will make you stand out.
I love that. Jin, we might have to dedicate just a podcast alone to that debate, whether it's talking about minimizing weaknesses or working on your strengths. I mean, that's one of the things I could talk about for hours, 100%, without a doubt.
Here we go, Ben. There's another idea.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Scott. but so speaking of your strengths, I mean, speaking itself is clearly one of them. And one of the things you do with Scott Monte Strategies is, of course, keynote speaking. So I think this is an awesome opportunity for some actionable advice, something that Jin and I are, of course, trying to push on this show. How did you get good at public speaking? Were you always good, and how'd you get better?
Boy, that's a great question. You can tell I'm stalling for time because it goes back quite a ways. You know, believe it or not, I am a bit of an introvert. And not that I don't enjoy talking to people. It's just that I get my energy from time alone, from quiet time, from reading, from kind of being in smaller groups. And yet I find that when I step up on the stage, there's a certain energy that I get. It's just that I don't like hanging out in large groups of people. And my parents said, when I was at a family wedding, when I was, gosh, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years old, that I was working the room. They said I was like the little mayor of the room, walking around, saying hi to everybody, shaking hands. And, you know, I remember giving a presentation in, it was a summer internship I had in college. Had to give a big presentation in front of a bunch of hospital administrators, and really enjoyed it. And I just feel really comfortable up on stage. I cross-registered when I was an undergraduate at Boston University and into the College of Communications. And I took a class that was required of all communications students when they were juniors. I took it, I think, when I was a senior. It was a course called Oral Presentation. And it was taught by one of the top radio guys in Boston at the time. And I blew him away. He gave me an A+ in the class. We learned interview styles. We learned debate. We learned comedy. We learned just storytelling, exposition, et cetera. And I just really enjoyed it. And ever since then, every time I've had an opportunity to stand up and address a group of people, either extemporaneously or with prepared remarks, I've been really comfortable and I've done fairly well. And when I found that I could do that as part of my work, both, you know, as I was up and coming in the marketing and communications field as I worked at Ford Motor Company. And beyond that, I just, every time I had an opportunity to have a speaking engagement, I would take it.
And is that the way to get better? Is it solely practicing and just taking those opportunities to speak in front of people?
Well, I think that certainly helps. You know, there are there are courses you can take. There are mentors you can work with. There are other presenters you can watch. You know, to me, I've always been something of a, I don't want to say mimic because I think that cheapens it, but I have, I think what I would call kind of a musical ear. I can hear patterns and sense things. You know, I was trained classically as a musician, and I can kind of anticipate patterns. I can follow things, and you know, I've done my fair share of impressions as well. So to me, it's like it's having a musical ear for this. And if I can observe someone whom I admire and look at some of their styles and not simply get on stage or get in front of a microphone and replicate it, but find my own version of it that works for me. It's like anything else in this world. You find people whom you admire or whose work you admire, and you borrow from it and you build, and you borrow some more from another person and you build. And ultimately it's like a clay sculpture where you've added on globs of clay here and there, and you begin to mold it into the shape that works for you. And for me, that's what I've done. I've watched plenty of public speakers. I've watched plenty of successful people doing what they do, or listened to successful people do what they do, and realized that I could build something of my own that works specifically for me.
Just like you studied history, classic civilization in college, you understand the advantage of looking at the past. And in this case, when we're talking about the past, you're referring to some of the greatest speakers ever, borrowing what they've done, whether it's strategies, tone, and implementing it yourself to get your, to make your speaking even better, which is, I mean, why not borrow from the best? It's definitely the way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I look at some of the great interviewers of the last, I'll say 40 years or so. And there are three that I always point to. And I know there are more than this, but the mind thinks in terms of threes. And to me, three of the best interviewers are Larry King, Johnny Carson, and Howard Stern. And I would swap out Howard Stern with Terry Gross, because and if you haven't listened to the Fresh Air interview where Terry Gross interviews Howard Stern, it's a two-parter. Find that and listen to it, because you've got two of the greatest interviewers basically interviewing each other. And the thing with Howard and with Terry is they make people feel so comfortable. Right? They get their guests to let their guard down. And I think that's a talent, where it doesn't feel like an interview. It just feels like a conversation with an old friend. And I think that's a really, really important talent. With Larry King, believe it or not, Larry King never read the books of the guests or you know, really did a lot of research on the guests that came onto his show. Why? Because he just liked to ask questions. And he didn't have a prepared set of questions that he would ask. He would simply let the conversation take whatever direction it took. And believe me, you have to be extremely confident and comfortable with yourself as well as with your guests to be able to do that. And that was a talent. And with Johnny Carson, even though he was one of the biggest stars, the biggest star on television for a long time, he was the late night destination. We didn't have so many other options. He didn't always have to be the center of attention. It didn't matter whether he had a Hollywood star from the golden age of the studios on, somebody like John Wayne or Jimmy Stewart, or if he had some little old lady from Topeka, Kansas that had a potato chip collection. He made them feel like they were the most important person in the room at the time. And he never did anything to steal away their limelight at the time. So between those three styles of interviewing, you know, I think we can learn an awful lot about the power of conversation and the power of making people on the other side of the microphone feel comfortable and willing to open up.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because when, especially the example with Larry King, right? When you do an interview, you know, you want to make others, especially guests, feel comfortable with the topic you're talking about. And when you hang out with friends, you know, nobody ever like make an agenda of you, like, you know, for example, when me and Ben hang out, there's never a time where I'm like, let me make an agenda to talk about exactly what I want to ask him. It's kind of let a conversation flow and just see where it takes us. And that's where, you know, for example, podcasts, where any interview style should be, versus, you know, ask a question, answer, which that's such a good point, Scott. Thanks for sharing.
Look, any good interview, I think you still have questions left on your list. Because you've covered so many other things. And what does that mean? Well, it means perhaps you've got an audience that wants to know more, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll stay engaged with you, or perhaps you have an opportunity for another interview.
Absolutely. And actually, that's a good point. For anyone listening right now within the Fireside app, of course, there will be an opportunity to ask Scott questions at the end. So definitely hold those until the end. I promise we'll leave time for it. But I think discussing one of the craziest career transitions I've ever heard of, I think it's definitely time we discuss that. So you, Scott, you were doing a couple healthcare account management and director type work. And somehow you became the global head of social media and digital communications for Ford Motor Company. I think we all need to know, how did this happen? And please just talk all about this experience. I want to hear all.
Well, like everything in life, it was anything but a straight arrow. You know, I think if you ask anyone about their career, the days of staying within a single company and simply ascending straight up over the course of decades is very rare these days. I think you're seeing people spending, you know, fewer years at companies. I think 3 years on average is what we see now, maybe even less. And that's okay. You know, people are zigzagging up the ladder, and everybody's got a different path. And for me, I was working at an advertising and marketing firm. We did B2B advertising and marketing in the healthcare and high tech space. And social media was just becoming a thing. And I remember trying to convince the agency that we needed to focus on social media. And their attitude was, well, where's the revenue model? How do we make money off of this? And I assured them, stick with it. You will see. This is the direction the world is going, and you need to trust me on this. And I just saw a tweet this morning from Shane Parrish. I don't know if you guys know Shane Parrish, but he runs Farnham Street. Really, really smart site. A lot of different great mental models there. He talked about being comfortable looking like an idiot in the short term to look like a genius in the long term. And I thought, oh, I've been an idiot many times. Right? And this is where I was with this agency, trying to convince them that social media was the way that the world was going. And we had a client, I'll never forget this. We had a client, an early stage biotech company, and they wanted to do something in the thought leadership space. And, you know, of course you could recommend the old white paper and panels and brand publications and all that. But this was back when podcasting was brand new. And I came up with an idea for a podcast strategy for this client. You know, they could interview other people in the field and really showcase themselves as leading thinkers in this particular area of biotech. And their response was, well, can you give us a case study on this? We want to see if it works. And I said, you know, this technology, this podcasting thing has been out for all of 2 weeks. Do you want to read a case study or do you want to be a case study? And the rejoinder was, we want to read a case study. Well, that thud that you may have heard those many years ago was my head hitting the wall for the last time. And I realized that this is going no place. So I left that firm and joined a boutique consultancy that helped big brands understand social media strategy. And I was there for about a year when I got a call from Ford Motor Company, from the chief communications officer. And he said, well, we're developing this new role. Never had it before. You're going to be in charge of digital communications and social media. And I asked if I had to move to Detroit. I lived in Boston still. I said, do I have to move to Detroit? Because I was working virtually at the time. And I was working for a company that did a lot of interaction on IM, and we even had an office in Second Life. It seems like child's play now, but this was back in 2006, 2007. And the head of comm said, yeah, this is like a big executive job. We kind of need you at the headquarters here. And I said, not interested. And you could have heard a pin drop. And he said, are you sure? And to me, that response spoke volumes, because it wasn't someone standing up and saying, how dare you, sir? Do you know who you're talking to? We are Ford Motor Company. Now, there was a great degree of humility behind that. Are you sure? I said, yeah, I'm sure. The timing just isn't right, and this is really all new to me. So I'm going to say no thank you for now, but let's stay in touch. Well, what happened was, ever since that conversation, suddenly the power of suggestion, working with the human mind as it does, suddenly I saw Ford Motor Company everywhere. I saw them in the business press. I saw them in different trade publications. And all of a sudden, the company started turning a corner on its financials. You know, they had taken on a new CEO in September of 2006. Alan Mulally came from Boeing, from outside the automotive industry, to work at Ford. And this was 2 years later when I was speaking to the head of comms. And during that time, Ford was losing money hand over fist. But after that call, I noticed that Ford started turning the corner, started to report a profit. And in the spring of the following year, of 08, we reconnected. And lo and behold, they still hadn't filled the position. They had spoken to about 50 people in between. My name kept coming up. And they said, why don't you just humor us and come out to Detroit and meet with a few people? No strings attached. And so I did. And almost from the moment that I walked in the building, I was overwhelmed. This was the world headquarters of a company founded by the guy who changed the face of the earth, who changed how we get everywhere and do everything. Henry Ford, and his name is still on the company today. And the people I met with were passionate and intelligent and talented. And I sensed there was something special going on there. And particularly around the passion. You can't invent passion out of nothing. There was something special happening with this company. And between everyone I talked to, the culture change that was afoot, and where I saw the company going in the next couple of years, and where I saw social media going in the next couple of years, I thought there is going to be a great convergence by about 2010, where all of this stuff comes together, and this company, pun intended, is going to be firing on all cylinders. And that's exactly what happened. Now, when I announced to my network that I was taking a job with Ford, people thought I was crazy. But why would you go to work for a loser of a company like that? Why don't you go to work for a winner like Toyota? My response was, I would rather be part of a comeback story than riding somebody else's coattails. I want a chance to make an impact, to make a difference in how we communicate with each other and how a big brand can start to be thought of rather than simply doing the same old, same old. And that's how I ended up at Ford.
Wow. That is a powerful story. Thank you so much for telling us that. And one thing I noticed was you joined the company in 2008. I mean, that couldn't have been great timing to join a company, especially one could argue a consumer discretionary thing if you have an operating car. Was that a factor in, I guess you could say, joining at an interesting time? Of course, social media was starting to blow up as well, but what effect did the financial crisis have?
So I mentioned the company had started doing better when I was paying more attention to them. The first quarter of 2008, Ford filed a $100 million quarterly profit, and the goal was to make Ford profitable again by the end of 2009. That's what the new CEO said he would do. And it looked like, for all intents and purposes, the company was on that trajectory. I joined in mid-July of 2008, and on July 28th, 2 weeks after I joined, the company filed its quarterly earnings for the second quarter, and it lost $8.7 billion. The largest loss in the company's history. And from there, the entire automotive industry globally, as well as the financial industry, began to implode. It basically began that July and extended into the fall, where you recall that Ford and GM and Chrysler were up in front of Congress testifying on the need for bailouts for the industry. Now, the good news is Ford didn't need that money. Ford had already taken out its $26 billion home improvement loan 2 years before. But it knew that it relied on the same global supply chain that GM and Chrysler did. And if those two were in danger, they could take the rest of the supply chain down with them, which would in turn affect Ford and the entire global automotive industry. So we knew we were fighting for the heart and soul of manufacturing in America, and we stood up for the other companies. So during that time, that late July, early August time period, my family was actually still back in Boston. And When I saw exactly how dire the numbers were, I called my wife and I said, "Don't finish packing. You may not need to come out here." Within a couple of weeks, we knew it was going to be okay. I mean, we basically were in crisis mode for a good 6 months, but we had a plan, and that was the key: was having a plan, and then communicating the plan to everyone. And social media played a big role in how we communicated it. And social media ended up, over the ensuing years, being part of the story about how Ford was transforming itself. So it wasn't only telling its story through social media, but the very use of social media at a company that size, being that progressive, was part of the story of Ford's technological transformation during the time. So it was the vehicles themselves, it was the company, and it was our way of storytelling that really fascinated people and changed people's perception of the company. And that's what we had set out to do.
Well, that's really interesting, Scott. Just a follow-up question. How much support you gather from your family with all the, you know, change careers and moving to places? What kind of, you know, impact that, or support that you got from your family?
Well, we've made transitions at, you know, key parts in our life. Our kids were younger when I took the opportunity at Ford. That was part of the decision process. You know, now our kids are, well, we've got three. Two of them in their teenage years. One is seven. So we always take that into account in terms of, you know, their stability and how we manage together as a family. But, you know, I think the Ford years were fascinating because even though so much of it was happening in crisis mode, there was still a sense of stability beneath it all.
Interesting.
And, you know, I think that made a huge difference in how we approached it.
God, it must have been such an incredible experience. I mean, being a part of a role that you were the first to be in that role. You had no blueprint, no prior person to lean on or anyone to know, oh, what did we do in the past in this certain scenario? So, I mean, you learned as you went and you kind of figured things out as they went. And I'm curious, what was your experience with that specific scenario where it was a new role? Was it kind of just a learn as you go, or did you take things from your healthcare years? How was that?
Well, it was an interesting combination because on the one hand, we were paving the road behind us, as you say. There was no roadmap for where we were going. At the same time, I was part of a 100-year-old institution. I was part of a team of people that still did very traditional communications and marketing work. And we were all kind of in flux. So we relied on the tried and true when we could, but we also had to be comfortable to get out of our comfort zone, right? To know enough to say, well, we're going to try something. Don't know if it's going to work or not. And I think part of that was simply this culture of moving forward, of trying new things and not necessarily holding it over someone's head if something didn't work, and moving on and figuring out what you did right, what you did wrong, how to improve the next time around. There was a phrase that we would hear in our meetings all the time when we presented plans for what we were doing. You know, you go in and you put your best foot forward, and it gets critiqued by other people around the room, and they all contribute to you know, improving it, to giving you ideas maybe you didn't have before. That was the wonderful thing about being part of a company like Ford. There are people all over the world at this company that had, in some cases, seen things you haven't seen before, and they would jump in and help out and all contribute to making what was called for every time the better plan. What's the better plan? Right? Oh, here's my plan. Okay, that's great. Now what's the better plan? Right? Always looking to improve ourselves. And I think our spirit of really not looking at our competition. You know, Henry Ford had said that if you want to succeed, don't pay any attention to your competition. Just keep moving forward. That's what we did. We didn't look to the other auto companies to inspire us. We looked at the best companies in the world doing digital comms and social media. We looked at Coca-Cola. We looked at General Electric. We looked all around. Whenever people were innovating, we looked for inspiration everywhere, and then we applied it to ourselves in the best way we knew how. I'll give you a great example. In 2009, about a year after I got there, we brought in a group called Blue State Digital. This was the agency that had helped the Obama campaign in 2008. Now, if you remember the Obama campaign, it was considered very digitally savvy. And everyone thought that the secret sauce lay in their social media approach. This was the first presidential campaign that really had the ability to use Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and the like. So we brought them in. We thought, well, what kind of campaign mentality can we take from the political world and apply to the corporate world? Right. And thinking of customers and potential customers and the public, quite frankly, just as a political campaign would. And when we brought them in, we discovered to our great surprise that the real difference with the Obama campaign simply came from their email capabilities. It sounds almost anticlimactic. It sounds like we're going against type, but really this digital behemoth, this juggernaut that plowed over everyone, succeeded via email. Yeah, it succeeded over email because they knew that in order to get people interested, all they needed at first were three pieces of information. Remember, I said before how the human brain understands three things at a time. They needed your first name, they needed your email address, and they needed your zip code. And that's it. And yet, how many times have we gone on to a company's website or tried to download a piece of content, a white paper, etc., and a company has required anywhere between 11 and 33 pieces of information out of us? On a first date, before we've even gotten the content, they want all of that information out of us. That's flipping the trust equation. It should be the other way around, right? They're asking us to trust them the first time. Well, we're asking them to trust. We're asking for them to trust us instead. And so that's what the Obama campaign started with, three pieces of information. And from there, after they built a relationship with you, they could ask you for more information. But at least if they had your first name, they could address you by your first name. If they had your zip code, they could give you things that were going on in your area that mattered to you. And every single email that they sent out, and they tested them widely in terms of image placement, in terms of subject line, but every single email that went out had three components. Here's what you missed. Here's what's happening next. Here's how you can get involved. That's it. A simple formula, three things. Here's what you missed. Here's what's happening next. Here's how you can get involved. And that is how the Obama campaign rode to success. And we thought if we could take those principles and apply them to our own sites, our own properties with Ford, how we could build relationships with people over time would lead to them trusting Ford and ultimately lead to greater purchase consideration and a better reputation for the company.
Simple is almost better. Right, especially with information overload into the society where sometimes we get overloaded with so much information and we can barely remember any of them. Right, like you said, Scott, we only remember three things at a time. And with the strategy, you know, it works out perfect in Obama's interest. It kind of, you know, sparked my interest to ask you the next question is, I'm just curious, what's your favorite social media platform?
I suppose I should say Fireside Chat since we're on it. Look, every one of them has a different purpose, although I will say they are becoming more and more alike one another as they copy different features that the other has. You know, we've seen this in Facebook's constant war with everybody else, how Instagram has copied features of Snapchat, and then of TikTok. We see how Twitter now has, their spaces capability, their audio capability, their tipping capability. We're seeing YouTube continue to adapt as well. I mean, they've all got something different. And so for me to say I've got a favorite, it depends on what I'm trying to do, really. My preferred mode of communication is in writing. I feel like I can take my time. I can be as succinct or as verbose as I need to be. I can incorporate the wisdom of so many other sources and link to them fairly easily. But I also realize that asking someone to dedicate time in their life to reading something is almost a dying art. You really need a connection with someone in order to want them to read what you're writing. And I think we need more readers. And I'm not talking just about online either. We need people to read more because there is so much knowledge bound up in not only history, but just great literature and even fiction. You can find yourself inspired by so many different writers of, you know, of ages gone by as well as the modern age. And it to me, it helps the creativity. It helps the strategy. It helps you understand how the world works. And quite frankly, in some cases, is a shortcut around making the same mistakes yourself. Seeing how other people have gotten themselves out of a similar jam, how, you know, just as I said, how Ford, how we borrowed from a completely different industry because we were paying attention. You know, and I think that's what we need more of. We need people to contribute more of their attention to things rather than flitting from platform to platform or from video to video. You know, as wonderful as the evolution of the opposable thumb has been in human history, it is our downfall now as we swipe from one minimal piece of content to the next. Thank you. Thank you very much, people clapping in the audience. We need to spend more time on things. We need to be more thought-driven. And if you want to be a good writer, you have to be a good reader. And writing is hard because it's thinking. But we need more thinkers.
Wow. That's powerful. And I could not agree more. It's so true. I mean, we could have a whole conversation on the pros and cons of social media, what it's done to humans, how we communicate and interact behind a screen. I mean, again, a whole conversation for that. And I do want to keep my promise to the audience to ask Q&A. I could ask 5-10 more questions, probably. I'm sure Jin could as well. But at this time, I will allow anyone to ask Q&A for Scott. Anything? I mean, there's probably so many things people want to ask. So please place your question. We'll invite you on stage here.
I see some familiar faces out there in the audience. Hopefully we'll get a few good questions. Otherwise, I'll be very disappointed in you people.
No, you got a speaker request here.
Hi. And Scott, I could tell that story about the nonchalantness of the Ford guy played a big impression because I've heard it from you like 5 times.
Thanks, yeah. Ariel.
No problem. I just wanted to ask, like, you know, we got like a whole new generation of like entrepreneurs and thinkers coming up. And sometimes I hear a lot of older people say, well, like, I've had it bad when I was young and things were really like terrible. So let them kind of suffer too. But I'm kind of opposed to that. I'm thinking, like, why not say, here are the mistakes I've made. Here's where I've gone to a little bit of trouble or I didn't know what I was doing. So let me pay it forward. Like if we had more of a pay it forward mentality from our older people, because I mean, we did grow up in a time of a recession, which I didn't know if, you know, the boomers had or anything like
that. Yeah. And I think that's a great observation, Ariel. You know, the question is, do you want to be a mentor to the next generation, or do you want to be, you know, like a fraternity brother hazing the next pledge class coming up? There's no reason to exact some harshness on people simply because you've been through it. I mean, that doesn't do the world any good. I mean, certainly you want to develop in people a sense of toughness, a sense of grit and resilience, but there are ways to do that, and there are ways to coach them. You know, the most important role we have as leaders is to coach and train the next generation of leaders. And you have to ask yourself, what kind of leaders do we want to see? You know, I think you think about, and I don't know how familiar everyone is with Antarctic history, but if we can go to the explorers of Antarctica from the early 1900s, Robert Scott, Captain Scott, was on a race against Roald Amundsen from Norway to get to the South Pole first. This was around, gosh, I want to say it was around 1910 or so. And Scott was a Navy man, right? He was born and bred in the British Navy, and he was harsh, and he had men out there scrubbing decks and doing all the things that you would do in the Navy in Antarctic conditions. And he was oblivious to the needs of his men. He just knew this was the way things should be done. Well, ultimately, Scott and his team of four others made it to the South Pole, only to find that Amundsen had beaten them by about 10 days. They were obviously disheartened. They turned around. They drove the sleds back, the dogs pulling the sleds, and they were within 5 miles of getting back to the depot when they died of exhaustion and exposure in a blizzard, all because Captain Scott drove his men. Whereas Ernest Shackleton, 2 years later, returned to the pole. He had been on a few expeditions with Scott. He returned to the pole with a team of about 40 men, and his goal was to march across Antarctica, to be the first to cross the entire continent on foot. I mean, you think about the things that people did in those days. We are complete snowflakes by comparison. But long story short, Shackleton's ship ended up getting trapped in the ice, couldn't move, got crushed. He had to move all of his men off of the ship onto ice floes. They floated on ice floes for 5 months until the ice finally started to break up as the spring came around. They got into their three lifeboats. They sailed a few hundred miles, finally found an island, a deserted island. And Shackleton the next day decided, I'm going to take five men with me, or four men with me. There was a team of five. We are going to sail and try to get to this whaling depot that is 800 miles away. He sailed through hurricane conditions. He landed on the wrong side of the island. They made a 36-hour march over mountains through crevasses. They found the folks at the whaling depot, returned. Not a single man was lost in that expedition because Shackleton was flexible, and he found what his men thrived on, and he put people on assignment that on assignments of things they were good at doing. He looked at their personalities, and he moved with the time. And I think that's what we need to do with our next wave of leaders, is to inspire them and to find what motivates them and to work with them rather than to simply beat them into submission.
Right. We need to make a foundation so we can rise to the occasion. That's what I like saying.
Yeah.
This is amazing. It's like that on Fireside, now that I have like Ariel's insights and I say diving into a sea of philosophy to pull up nuggets of wisdom, maybe I'll do one on leadership. And maybe
there you go. Let me know.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely. I'm if you check your Twitter messages. Yeah, cool. Thank you so much.
You got it.
Awesome. Well, thank you for the question and comment, Ariel. And awesome story once again, Scott. An amazing storyteller. Are there any last questions for Scott? If not, we'll leave it to Scott to close the conversation. But please, if there are any other questions.
I thought I saw another microphone or two pop up there, but maybe folks got distracted. Ah, there she is.
Stephanie. Oh, love hearing from Stephanie.
I love the greeting. Hello.
Hello there.
How are you, Scott Monty?
I am well, Stephanie. It's been a while.
It's been a while. And Ben and Jen, thank you for inviting me to the stage. I love your show. Keep doing it. Scott, I'm curious, I'm curious if you have any either research or just even down to gut instinct on, you know, we know that there are corporations across the United States and certainly globally that have always valued empowering and providing ongoing education in leadership for their executive, you know, SVPs, VPs, et cetera. And certainly some of those companies have always been in that top, right? Best places to work with different accolades. Now, do you think that post-pandemic, with us seeing the data so far on employees who are saying, you know what, you weren't treating me that great before this. And now that I've been working from home and I'm seeing my family again and I'm cooking and I'm actually breaking bread with my husband, if you, you know, or wife, you know what, maybe I need to look at you and say, what have you done for me lately?
Yeah.
And so for companies who haven't focused on leadership, who haven't focused on empowering their managers and their leaders to learn how to be leaders, because that's not necessarily an innate skill. Oftentimes it's not. Do you see, or do you have any predictions about sort of this, again, I knock on wood when I say post-pandemic, because I'd like to believe that we really are going to be post-pandemic, but presuming that we are, do you think that we're going to see more corporations who prior to the pandemic didn't necessarily value this or weren't really focused on it? Do you think you're going to see now in the world of leadership a focus on employee sort of happiness? I mean, that's a very general word, but what do you see? Because it all surrounds the importance of, right, good leaders who people want to actually follow.
Yeah. Well, I think you're astute to recognize that, Stephanie. I think we are definitely a changed people after the last year and a half. We have to be. If we simply go back to life as it was before, I think we'll have learned nothing. And if anything, I think this recognition of the importance of leadership and the different aspects of leadership, and this is part of what I talk about on my show on Timeless Leadership, is, you know, when we promote people, when we move them from line employee, you know, an individual contributor, usually because they're very good at what they do. Maybe they're an expert in direct marketing, or they're an expert in product design, and suddenly they become a manager or a leader of others. Well, what do they have that qualifies them to do that other than being really good at their function? You see what I'm saying? So in other words, we've given them nothing in terms of how to inspire and manage people when they've been really good at managing projects, managing assignments, managing the development of a particular thing. And it's a very different set of skills. And I think this more human side of leadership that we've seen, or that we've seen the need for over the last year, things like empathy and vulnerability and integrity, you know, these intangible aspects, these qualitative features that maybe the quants get all nuts over because you can't measure that stuff. Well, you can measure the outcome. You know, I talked to Tom Peters a couple of weeks ago on my show, and he has been saying this for four decades of consulting work. People first, people first. And if you want to have the best employees, if you want to inspire people, if you want to make people stick around, then you really do need to put them first. And I just saw something today. I can't remember exactly where it was, but it's this. There is a discussion happening where employers are wondering if they're going to be able to retain employees as they go back to the office. And the question is, what kind of arrangements are you making? Is it a hybrid kind of thing where you only need them in the office one or two days a week, right? And you give them the flexibility to work when and where they want the other days of the week. I think more companies are going to need to accommodate that rather than simply demanding everyone be in the same place at the same time. These companies have managed and in some cases have shown over the last year that they can do it. They can manage remotely. And there are certain aspects of employee interaction and morale that do require us to see each other from time to time, but perhaps not to the degree that we did. And I think the companies that show that they are listening to their employees and that understand that the person who gets satisfaction out of that 1 hour commute because they can decompress between home and work may be different than the person who needs to be home at dinner time or who needs to be at a Little League game or who needs to put a kid to bed. Right? And we are all coming to this with different needs and priorities.
So, yeah, it's going to be so interesting, I think, Scott, to see how this unfolds and what corporations look around and say, maybe we've been doing it wrong. And maybe we need to actually make an investment in our people, right? In terms of not only what we're allowing relative to your zip code that you want to work in, but also investing in your people relative to, again, not everybody is a born leader. And I even think born leader is wrong. I think that leading and managing is a skill set that some people innately are good at, but there are indeed things that we can learn from it. So I think it's going to be really interesting. So Scott, I've really enjoyed this conversation. Ben and Jen, thank you for hosting this conversation. It's been really interesting. And Scott, thanks for that conversation around that question. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Stephanie. You are awesome.
Yeah, thank you so much, Stephanie. That was an awesome, thoughtful question. And Scott, I think we'll close it here by asking where people can reach you if they want to speak with you, get a keynote speaking engagement for Scott Monte Strategies or et cetera. Where would be the best places for people to reach you?
ScottMonte.com. It's as simple as that.
Wonderful. Scott, thank you so much for an awesome conversation. This was really fun. Love the audience.
Oh, and you guys are the best.
Yeah, audience really is the best. I love it. And Scott, thank you again. And I hope you have a great rest of your night over here.
All right, gentlemen. Keep doing what you do.
We will do that. Thank you very much.
Well, that will do it for this week's episode of Aspire and Inquire. We hope you enjoyed it, learned a ton, and can use it to your advantage going forward in your own career. As always, you can find us on social media at Aspire_Inquire. You can find our website at aspireandinquire.com. And we're always looking for new amazing guests to feature on the show. If you know someone or you yourself can feature on our show, reach out to us. You can email us at aspireinquired@gmail.com or find another way to get to us. We want to hear from you. But in the meantime, stay tuned till next week's amazing episode.